at the DNA chain of tradition, and it's going to involve the discovery of the Cohen gene. So we're going to learn a little bit of science, and then we're going to talk about how it applies to Torah, and I'll give you a little overview of what we're going to discuss. First, the idea of Torah and science, and then the process of this discovery in genetics of a link from the Jewish people of today back to our ancient past through genetics. We'll talk a little bit about DNA and the science of it, some definitions. We'll talk about what are Kohanim, what is a Kohen, what is the family, what are the tribes, tribe of Levi, back to Jacob, Israel, a little bit of history. And then we'll review the results of the genetic tests, the hypothesis, the discovery, how it came about, and then the results of the various tests and how it opened up a whole new field of population genetics. And recently another article came out about linking all of the Jewish people back to the Middle East through the genetic markers, which we're going to talk about. Then the applications of these findings, applications like now that we have these Hebrew markers, they start to look for other groups that connect to the Jewish people, to the Hebrews, and the lost tribes, and these concepts. And then applications, and then implications. Well, what does it mean if we found this out, this very significant information? So then we're going to sum it up, take questions. Basically, when we talk about Torah, we're talking about wisdom, God's communication to mankind. And that's what we know is truth. That's a revelation of truth and reality. Science is also meant to be a description of reality. It takes small aspects of physical reality and examine it really well. So there should be no conflict really between Torah and science. One is the study of the physical world, which is science, and the other is really the larger, the big picture, and that's Torah. So it's a mistake to think that there needs to be a conflict between science and Torah, between religion and secular knowledge. They should go together, right? When there's a conflict, so then depends on one's values where one decides the conflict. But if a rational person makes decisions, Judaism is a very rational religion, worldview, philosophy. It says use your mind, don't turn it off, use it. Ask questions and find answers, make decisions. And science is meant to also be a rational exploration of reality. Let's find out how things work and what's next and how it goes. So that's why we can use science and not be afraid of science. Genetics was a sort of a field that was by religious or was looked sort of at askance. You know, you're going to talk about very personal things. Now, genetics is a way of now working it with molecules to understand the reality of life. No conflict necessary between science and religion. Please come on in, we're just starting.
One thing you said here, does anybody here from the Vancouver group? Is anybody here from Vancouver?
Okay. That's okay. Yeah. So, let's talk a little bit about the discovery of the so-called Cohen gene. Karl Skuretsky is a physician, also a kidney expert, originally from Toronto. We're sitting in shul one day, and he's a Kohen, which means he has a tradition from his father and his father's father, entire line that goes back to Aaron. Aaron, the brother of Moshe, from the time of the giving of the Torah. The Torah tells us there's a line of Kohanim. These will be the men who will do the temple service. They'll give a blessing every day. There'll be a conduit. There'll be a sort of a pipeline from Hashem to the people. There'll be both a messenger of Hashem. There'll be a messenger of the people. And They're Jews. They're among the nation of Israel. But just they have a particular role, this particular job. Just like there's a king, that's the line of King David, never broken, and we expect a future king as well from that same line. So there's a line also of the priesthood. Now, priest is not exactly a Jewish word, but it's come to mean this is one who does the temple and the religious service. He's the one who went into the inner sanctum to perform the various avodah, the services of the temple. And he was a family of the tribe of Levi, was the Kohanim from Aram. So Skoretsky, Professor Skoretsky, sitting in shul, he's a Kohen, and he sees another Kohen given an aliyah. One of the rights or the honors of the Kohanim, of this family, is to be given the first aliyah, the call to the Torah. They're given an extra honor, they're given an honored place among Am Yisrael, among the Jewish people. So the Kohen is called for an aliyah, is a guest in the shul that day, and he's a Kohen whose parents had come from Morocco, from North Africa. So Professor Skoretsky, whose parents had come from Eastern Europe, was kind of tall and light, fair-haired, some fair-skinned, and the person who got the aliyah was Sephardi. His, for the past generations, family had been in Morocco, Northern Africa, and physically somewhat different, a little shorter, a little darker, and yet he's a Kohen. So Professor Skoretsky, knowing about genetics, you know, so physically we look a little different, but yet we have a tradition that we have the same great-great-great-grandfather, right? So we should have the same genetic makeup to some extent. So this was the beginning of the hypothesis. Can we see, is there really a genetic connection, a hereditary connection between the Kohanim who live today, people who identify themselves as Kohens, and our ancient past? So Professor Skoretsky knew about the breakthroughs in genetics. All of the life sciences and medicine have been opened up through the technology which has been developed around the knowledge of the DNA chain. Every nucleotide is unique. Every connection in the DNA chain is unique, and if it changes, it's noticeable. If it changes in an area of the DNA which makes a protein, which is called a gene, genes are things that translate, they give the information to make an amino acid. The links of the amino acids makes a protein. Enough proteins make a cell and an organ and an organism. So that the DNA gives the instructions, gives the coding. And the coding is done is through four chemicals, which are given letters, and it becomes like an alphabet. An A, a T, a C, and a G. And an A always matches with a T, and a C with a G. So that's why if it splits, it can find these chemicals, these molecules in the environment, and make a double strand, make a new strand. That's how heredity happens. That means an original splits, becomes two, and this one is joined, and this one is joined, and now you have two individual strands of DNA, a copy of the information from the original. All DNA is double-stranded until it splits, until the cell splits, and then it creates its new site. All the DNA is replicated in every cell in the body. So, and a lot of the DNA, so we say part of the DNA gives instructions for the making of amino acids, which then make a protein. Much of the DNA doesn't code for anything. It's not a gene. A gene means part of the DNA that codes for a protein. A lot of the DNA doesn't code. If anything happens to these particular letters, which we're saying letters, these molecules along the chain, a change in any of these is called a mutation. Something changed from what originally was passed down, which is an exact copy, except for a mutation, a small change. Now these mutations, if they happen in part of the DNA that makes a protein, that is a gene, then that's a problem. Because one change, one mutation of one nucleotide, one letter in the alphabet, is going to make a mistake. It's not going to be able to be coded into a proper amino acid to make a proper protein. Therefore, there's going to be a failure somewhere, and a mutation is a problem if it happens in a gene. However, if it happens in part of the DNA that doesn't make something, doesn't code for a protein, so it can carry on in the chain of the DNA from generation to generation. And a mutation will happen in this line somewhere here, and it'll be passed. Mutation will happen in someone else somewhere along the line, it'll be passed. And then down the line of the generations, you're going to see different groups of slight changes in people's DNA. Now, most of the DNA among all human beings is 99.5% the same, because it's all about the various functions that we need. In fact, most of our DNA is the same as most other living things, even such creatures as bacteria. There's a very great commonality of the DNA. DNA it's a whole fascinating science of these codes that we have more than 2 billion in each, 2 billion nucleotides, letters in each person's DNA. Yeah? Well, the DNA is basically the same as Noah. In fact, the fact that the DNA is basically the same is going to help us look back into history and to see the connections, right? So, in fact, when we're talking about DNA, and let me apologize, you know, the only science degree that I got was in political science. So I'm on about the same foot. We're learning this together. But it's important to have the basics of it, because it's such an explosive field. We're learning about the human genome, which is that we're mapping all of the DNA in the human body, which means now we can locate where the genes are, where the failures are, where the mistakes are, where the misprints happen, and help prevent genetic diseases. There's also genetic engineering, which is now playing cut and paste with the genes, and, you know, lo and behold, you have, you know, corn that preserves much better. I mean, we're on a cusp here of a revolution which is based on our knowledge of the DNA. Now, what we're talking about today is using the DNA as a way of looking through back in history. You know, not how we're changing genes and affecting organisms. We're looking at that part of the DNA, the non-coding DNA that goes along in everybody's cells, and it carries those mutations from those past generations. And because people come from different lines, there are different groups of mutations in the genome, in the DNA code of each individual. Now what this is doing is trying to get at those differences and seeing what we can learn from which came earlier, who came from where, and learning about populations from matching and seeing which mutations, which groups of mutations, which are called a haplotype, are found among which people. So Professor Skoretsky is sitting in shul. He says, I'm a Kohen, and this fellow from Morocco is a Kohen, and yet we look differently, but we have a tradition of a same, you know, genetic heritage. Can we check it out? Can we test this? He got in touch with Professor Michael Hammer, who was one of the leaders in Y chromosome studies. Now, the Y chromosome is very interesting. That's the male chromosome. You know, if a person has, from his parents, from his mom and his dad, he gets one contribution. All the chromosomes are paired. Right, so we make a contribution, one from the mother, one from the father. Now, the chromosome package pair that determines whether a person's male or female. So a person, if he has two X's, she's a female. If he has an X and a Y, that's a male. If your dad gives you the Y, you become a male. If your dad gives you an X, you become a female, because your mother is always giving you an X. Right? So X and Y, that's a male. Now this Y chromosome is very unique, because most of the chromosomes, why are we a combination of our parents? Because there's mixing along the chromosomes. Various genes exchange. Therefore, blue eyes, brown eyes, which one is dominant? The mom had, and you come out with brown eyes or blue eyes, depending on the combination. Sometimes it's a chance combination. Sometimes it's dependent. Two brown eyes, well, you certainly will have brown eyes. These are sort of genetic principles that apply to the genes. Now, we're talking about now the area of the DNA that doesn't code. So, okay, let's see. I lost the thread here. We'll go back to Skoretsky gets in touch with Hammer. The Y chromosome is unique. It doesn't exchange. All the two matched chromosomes exchange material. That's your mixture of your father and your mother. The Y is unique. It has the X, and it's a small little chromosome. What's a chromosome? Is a little protein casing of DNA. DNA is a long, 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 long molecule. It's this helix, double helix, and each letter we were talking about is like a step in the ladder. But it's super coiled, this DNA. It's just not long and straight. It's super coiled around itself and inside of that, and that's the chromosome. That's the chromosome. It's chromosomal body. It just means it shows up when it's colored. I mean, it's a package of DNA as a chromosome. And the way we are packaged is that there's 23 pairs of chromosomes. And each one has different things on it. Medically, they're finding genes on certain chromosomes that if there's a problem on a certain gene, they know that this could translate into a problem in the organism. But we're talking about the Y chromosome. Y chromosome, the most important information that it carries is maleness. It has the instruction to produce what turns the organism to be male. So, but it doesn't combine with the X there. That's the point. So this Y chromosome you're getting from your dad, and he got it from his dad, and he got it from his dad. Hardly any changes in it, because it's not recombining. The only changes that there are, rare changes, are these slight mutations where one of these letters, a C, will change to a G. Either through a copying problem or somewhere comes a mutation. It's what can cause mutations? They say that subatomic particles can cause mutations. Well, things rarely but do change along the DNA chain. So now you take that Y chromosome, which is available now. There's a whole technology of getting to the DNA. You can pinpoint the area that you want to look at. So they look at parts of the Y chromosome that may have mutated. Right, so now we get to what are we finding out here? What do we see here? You see a combination of mutations that is unique to a certain population. So the hypothesis is, if the Kohanim are all related, so then their father's genes should be what they are showing themselves. Right? The same haplotype, same group of mutations will be found among the Kohanim today to a higher percentage than among other Jews and then among other people. That's the hypothesis. Right? Because the Y chromosome goes back all the way to one's father's father's father. It's passed down without recombining. So
it doesn't recombine with the mothers.
No, it doesn't recombine with the mothers. That's the uniqueness of this Y.
But that's just for maleness, doesn't that make you the same color?
No, those genes are on other chromosomes. There's a few other genes on the Y chromosome, but the most significant one is determining of maleness.
So the theory is that all males of the should look the same?
Not look the same, should carry the same genetic markers on the Y chromosome. Right. They should carry the same genetic markers on the Y chromosome in a much higher percentage than does the general population, even other Jews, right? Because other Jewish people, first of all, being Jewish is not a genetic definition, right? For the definition of Jewishness goes from the mother. So if another Y chromosome comes in from outside, marries a Jewish mother, the child will have the father's non-Jewish Y chromosome, but he's Jewish, right? So, whereas by the Kohanim, it has to come from the father's line. So therefore, it's traceable from the father's line. A mother, a Kohen has to marry a kosher Jewish mother so that the child will still be a Kohen. But the line of Aaron, that goes male directly down the line. That's right. The child is not a Kohen, and even though he's got this Y chromosome, these markers, and in fact, so the only Kohen in the cabinet is not even Jewish. I mean, William Cohen, right? Secretary of Defense, right? In the United States, his father's Jewish, Mr. Cohen. His mother not. He was raised not. And he may even have this Y chromosome, most likely he would if his father had the line, but it's not a Kohen. Because from his mother's side, the mother's side determines. Jewishness is not a genetic definition, it's a halachic definition. The Torah tells us that the line goes after the mother. We see where it says not to intermarry, it says don't let your daughter marry their sons, because their sons will try to influence your grandchild. Meaning that if the non-Jewish pair, the non-Jewish spouse, is a male, and the Jewish girl marries a non-Jewish male, so the grandson is still Jewish. So be careful that the Jewish father, the non-Jewish father, doesn't take your Jewish grandson away from.
So, yeah, it has nothing to do with genetics; it has to do with spirituality.
That's right. It's the Torah defines, right?
Yeah.
So a person can be carrying this gene and not necessarily be a Kohen or Jewish,
yeah,
even. But the vast majority are. And what the results of this were is they took a sampling among Jews. Said, are you a Kohen, a Levi, or Yisrael? What is your oral tradition? And the results were very significant, that 99.7 of the Kohanim had a particular marker, the Y insert that was being studied at that time, and a much lower percentage of Jews, a high percentage still, but a much lower percentage, meaning that the Kohanim have a particular family line that is unique. And then they added on certain other markers just to make it more specific. And it turns out that between 80 and 90% of people who identify themselves as Kohanim today have the same genetic markers, which indicates they come from a common forefather. And now they've even used techniques of time measurement, how rapid the mutations happen, and they've clocked it back 3,000 years. 3,300 years is the time of the Exodus. That's the time of Aaron HaKohen. So not only do we have the amazing fact that the family of Kohanim are still very much intact, that the percentages are extremely high. There was a time when people thought, well, we've gone through such an exile and such a difficult time. Most likely all the families are lost, and who knows how much intermarriage there's been, and rapes and conversions. Who knows what happened to Jewish people? So this has come to show us that the line of the Kohanim, particularly, which are meant to be protected, especially Yichus, who they can marry, and so that very much made it down through history. And just recently, in fact, it was just last week in the Jerusalem Post, was another finding from this genetic studies. The headline was "Study Finds Genetic Link Between Jews and Palestinians." But the point is that it showed that all major Jewish groups, whether from the Middle East, or Yemen, or Spanish Jews, Sephardi Jews, Ashkenazi Jews, all have a common genetic types that relate back to the Middle East. That I'll read it to you some of the results. Since 586 BC, that's 2,500 years ago, when Jews dispersed across Europe and North Africa, Jews largely retained their genetic identity, one that was formed in the Middle East. Right? Even after centuries of exile, diaspora Jews remained closer to each other and more similar to Palestinians, Syrians, and Lebanese, which are the Semitic peoples, in terms of shared Y chromosome characteristics than to the people in their host countries, the study says. Meaning that even though Jews lived in Poland for between 500 and 1,000 years, they didn't intermarry. We don't have Polish male Y chromosomes among Ashkenazi Jews. We have Hebrew male chromosomes. Right? So that a low rate of intermarriage between diaspora Jews and Gentiles is a key reason for this continuity. Since Jews first settled in Europe 80 generations ago, the intermarriage rate was estimated to be only at about 0.5% each generation. So that's what kept us Am Yisrael. It was never lost. And there's a lot of time, you know, we're talking about 100 generations back to the giving of the Torah. And that means every generation, every father to son, kept it. Kept their tradition as a Kohen, and the larger Jewish people kept our tradition as Jews. We knew that we're carrying something very special, and it's not to be lost.
Carrying something special genetically?
Well, genetically we have... commandment, you know, not to intermarry, not to lose our gene pool also. Even though, like we say, Jewishness is not a genetic definition. It can convert in.
Why would you want to say if I were to marry a woman
non-Jew, right?
Wouldn't there still be a problem in the gene pool?
Well, we're not commanded to keep the gene pool, the fact is, right. No, halachic conversion for the right reasons is wide open. That's what we do. Judaism is not a genetic definition. It is a spiritual definition, right? But the Kohanim, which were, and the tribes, that's a genetic definition because the line of the tribes goes after the father. So the tribe of Levi as a genetic definition. Kohanim is a genetic definition, but it's also a spiritual definition. A person can be a Kohen by birthright and not know, you know, the first thing about what it means. A lot of us are Jews without knowing too much about what it means. And that's why, you know, it's critical at this generation for us to learn about it, to think about it. You know, each person will make his choices. Judaism is built on using your mind, make your choices. But it's very important that everybody gets the exposure to this information. Our generation, you know, is moving very fast and far away from our understanding of it's important to make your statement as a Jew, that our essential being as a person in this world is our Jewish neshama, our Jewish soul. We are human, and God chose us among humanity to carry a special message throughout the generations. What this genetic research shows us is that the tradition, which never got lost, has actually a genetic parallel, that our people ultimately never got lost.
Also kind of shows that people also have been
Yeah. That what? Sorry?
Have not been converting yet.
Yeah. Right. Now, there's also was this fear in Europe that perhaps the Cossacks came and they raped all of our grandmothers, God forbid. This is a fairly common thought. Maybe. This research shows that it's not the case. That given that there was input to the gene pool, that's natural. But if these figures are accurate, this very tiny amount of intermarriage, very tiny amount of other males from other nations, coming into Judaism, even more so, the fact is that Jewishness is the mother's definition, and so there's room for other Y chromosomes, so to speak, to come in. But yet even they didn't, So it's very powerful, I think, that shows the Jewish continuity. And then it brings us down to our generation, where all these groups are scattered all over the world, and now we're brought back to the land of Israel. The Arab nations hosted Jewish communities for 1,000 years. And in Europe, the Ashkenazi community also was nearly 1,000 years living among Germans. We maintained our culture and our unique qualities. And now we're gathered back into our land where, with some growing pains, we become once again the scattered tribes which are regathered. So in terms of these studies, now they say, what else can we learn from these genetic studies? So we've seen the Jewish cohesiveness among all of the diaspora groups, and among the Ashkenazim, it was once everybody here, a group that was called the Khuzars. Khuzar was a tribe, large tribe in Asia, Turco-Asian tribe. They all converted to Judaism in maybe the 8th century. There's a book called the Khuzari by Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, which uses this as a background for a presentation of Jewish ideas. As it seems that this king had a vision, and he called in a Muslim a mufti and a Christian priest, and then a Jewish rabbi. And the previous one said, "Well, all that we have is sort of based on the revelation that was given at Sinai to the Jews, but of course God gave it to us, So the king said, "Well, let's call in the Jews and see what they have to say." The rest of the book is a very interesting philosophical discussion, which then brought this king to decide Judaism is the right system, and we're going to, and his whole nation converted. That's the story. It's a legend. It's probably real to some degree. However, some people used it to say, well, the Ashkenazim Jews, they've been in Europe for hundreds of years, but they wandered from here to there. Where did they come from? Where's the origins from them? Maybe they're just all converted Khuzaris, Khuzars. And this was a common, in a book, somebody wrote a book. It was kind of a, when people are running away from the Jewishness and the Judaism, so it's another good stone to throw. We're not even Jewish anyway, so the fact is that they made these genetic studies and they looked at the Jewish people, modern Jews, their haplotypes, their combinations, and they looked at Turkish people and Asian people, and they see no commonality. If Ashkenazi Jews were derived from these tribes, or even partially, so it would show up in the male genes, and it just doesn't. So, it's another falsehood kind of tossed out. Another interesting finding was that the Levites, who really should show also a straight line of commonality, don't seem to show it. There's the Kohanim show this 80-90% commonality, and the Levites, who also should come from the same father, common male ancestor, don't quite show that. So it's a going to find out what happened with the Levites. Sometimes you're even in a in a congregation, you know, the Kohen gets the first Aliyah, the a Levite is called up for the second. Many times there's not Levites to be found. So they want to study what happened to the Levite population. And another application of this research is now that we have sort of this Hebrew gene, not really a gene, I explained a gene makes a protein, right? A gene loosely, but genetic markers, now that we have this information, maybe we can find this among other groups in the world, the so-called lost tribes. Our tradition is that after the destruction, really even before the destruction of the first temple, the 10 tribes of Israel were uprooted and taken to the east, and there they were scattered about, and discussion in the Talmud whether they will return again, in what degree they will return. Mostly they're considered as having assimilated into the countries there. However, they're still mixed among the majority of the Jewish people. Now, why are we called Jews? The word Jewish comes from Yehuda, Judah, which is this province down here, the south of Eretz Israel. The northern tribes were taken away early. They were Yisrael, they were Israel, taken away, never really to return. Until maybe the Messianic period, it's a possibility. So many people migrated to the south, where you had the tribes of Judah, and also there was Benjamin, and some of Shimon, and the tribe of Levi, because the Levites and Levi were responsible for the temple service. So, but you have the other 10 tribes mixed among the rest of the population. We became known as Jews from Judah, Yehuda. The majority of Jewish people come from the southern geographical area, which was the tribe of Yehuda. Right. So, can we find Jewish genes in other groups? So, interestingly enough, there are a number of groups, large populations, which claim connection to the Jewish people. There's a group that's on the border of Burma and India, the Shinlung, and they say they're from the tribe of Manasseh. They're Oriental looking, and there are now some efforts to bring some of them to Israel. They go through a conversion, because even if they have, again we say, you know, some Jewish connection, but halachically that's been severed through the generations, even if there was. Same thing with like the Ethiopians. Now, Ethiopians don't show the same genetic markers. They're the one group of the Yemenites do, the Persians, the Babylonians. So when the Ethiopians come to Israel, generally it's thought that they need to go through a conversion. So this is a way of reuniting the tribes, because what if a group has been so far off mainstream Judaism for so many generations, then, for example, the marriage laws and divorce laws are going to become very fuzzy. And that's one thing that we have to avoid fuzziness in, because it's very important to know who's from whom and proper marriages. That's what's kept us this many generations, and that's what's going to keep us as a united people. So that's the process of conversion. So even if someone finds out they may have some of these Jewish connections, they'll need to sort of rejoin the larger people here in Eretz Israel. So they found some of these Shinlung. There's a very interesting story in the Jerusalem Report. Has it also was picked up by CBS 60 Minutes, just ran a thing on in PBS. With the Kohen gene, which is the ancient Hebrew haplotype, can we see this among any other groups in the world? Interestingly enough, they found it among a tribe in Africa called the Lemba. Now, they have a tradition that their origins go back to the Hebrews. So they do some Jewish things, even though they're very eclectic. They do some Christian things as well. But it's a black tribe in South Africa. So they applied these genetic tests to these Lemba and found that there's this one particular family of the Lemba tribe which does indeed show a high percentage of the Hebrew genes. So it seems that their origin may have been either from Yemen, where there was a large Jewish community, or from merchants who would travel from the Middle East to Africa, perhaps got shipwrecked, stayed, founded a family. That family developed into a tribe. So they've actually found some Hebrew linkage in Africa. So that's another application of these findings, finding the Hebrew gene. So the implications are very powerful themselves, I think. The implications are that we never got lost, that God keeps his promises, particularly to the Kohanim. You see a number of times in the Torah where Hashem says, the Kohanim, the children of Aaron, the sons of Aaron, will never get lost. Let me read you a couple quotes. In the Torah it says, bring close Aaron, your brother, and his sons with him from the children of Israel to become Kohanim, priests, to me. So there it says in Exodus. Where it says to me, it means for all time. That's the Midrash. Then another quote from Exodus. And they shall have the kahuna as a statute forever. And you shall consecrate Aaron and his sons, and appoint them as you appointed their father, they may serve me. And it shall be for them an appointment for an everlasting kahuna throughout their generations. Everlasting, forever, never to be lost. You and your sons shall keep your kahuna as a gift of service for all time, an everlasting covenant of salt with God, with you and your descendants. So this is very, very powerful. A repetition. I have chosen him from all your tribes to stand and serve with the name of God and his sons forever. So what do you see here? God makes a promise, and you know the DNA lab shows, yeah, it came true. We're still here. The Kohanim are still here. The Jewish people who were scattered to the four corners are now gathered back to Israel. We're still here, both spiritually, culturally, and even genetically, even physically. You know, we are Am Yisrael. We are the Hebrews. We've changed a little bit in our what's called the phenotypes. You know, some of us are a little more look more European. Some look more North African. But that's all part of the mosaic that is being all over the world. If these physical genes, which represent such a tiny percentage of our genome, that make us our skin a little darker, a little lighter, our hair, you know, a little blonder, a little browner, those are genes that manifest quickly. If they show up in a gene pool, they can show a lot. So physical things can change much more quickly than does the real century-old, millennia-old connection that we're finding through this genetic testing. So if there's any questions, we'll... Yeah. Go ahead. Please go ahead.
Before I came to Israel, I'm from Toronto, and there was a show on the last time.
That's right.
One of the things he said was that
the Kohanim tribe wasn't, I mean, they're obviously people who know that they're Kohens, but that wasn't enough. When the Messiah comes in the third temple, they have to be sort of an unblemished class of Kohanims. And they thought that they had found some tribe that was had always made a point to isolate itself from the rest of the world. But really the point of this show, which I thought was interesting, was that these tribes were never lost to themselves. They were lost to us, but they always knew who they were. Mm-hmm. So that could be another interpretation of the passage that you just read.
Right. It's true these findings, which are very interesting, and they tell us about the general pattern of what's happened to Jewish people in the long exile, how we've survived it, but they don't determine who was yes a Kohen, who's not a Kohen, because we know the mother's side affects very much a kosher Kohen, and also, like you say, there's blemishes to serve in the temple. A Kohen had to be very, very normal. I mean, nothing that would call a distract one's attention from the service. You know, like you wouldn't use a broken pitcher or a broken menorah, so the man had to be a service vessel. A kohen is meant to be one who serves. He's not meant to be, you know, someone who's put up on a pedestal. He is the one who does the inner service in the inner sanctuary. And therefore, he had to protect himself from contact with the dead, not to defile himself, so-called, to go into a cemetery is a problem for a kohen. Who he marries, he has marriage restrictions because he's meant to be a holy man. He's meant to be the one who is with a teacher and a servant in the temple, and meant to be an example. Just like the Jewish people are called the Kohanim of the nations, which means we're meant to be spiritual examples to the rest of the world. If we're doing it right, we do it, people will say, that's beautiful, that's a wonderful way to live, that's a wonderful people, that's a wonderful nation, that's a wonderful thought system. If we're not doing it right, we get, what happened to them? Why would such a destruction happen to them? You know, God never lets us forget. If we live up to our responsibility, then this is God and we praise Him. And people will point at the beauty and the glory of Am Yisrael. If we fail to it, then we're still never forgotten. We're remembered as, what did God do that? You know, what's the message? We're carrying a message. Am Yisrael is carrying a message. The message that God is in this world. And if it's done properly, then it lights up the world. It brings God's presence, the Shekhinah, the temple's rebuilt, the Kohanim are back to work. And if not, the lack of that requires an answer. And the Jewish people become that example to make people question it, to make ourselves first question. You know, what is God doing in the world? You know, what is the message? One of the other implications of this very study is, why did God keep the Kohanim around? You know, what is the purpose of keeping us around to the end of time? And I think a very likely answer is that we've got work to do. The temple will indeed be restored. The Kohanim will be reorganized. First, probably through prophecy, Eliyahu HaNavi, who's a prophet, will come, you know, this, yes, this, no. But generally it says someone who assumes they're a Kohen, been living as these, as a Jew, as a Kohen, is accepted as such. And then, you know, move to the next level in Jewish history. Right now we're going through a very incredible time. 50 years ago, 60 years ago, we were ashes in Europe. Now, 50 years later, we're a brave, strong nation. And we're going through a lot of pulling and pulling. But where are we going? What are we ultimately going to? To the compilation of history, the fulfillment of history, as is promised. And we are in a generation that is in that cusp. You know, we're between generations. And those of us who see Torah as truth, as an explanation, a reality, shows you how God works in the world. You know, God's not up front. God is hidden. You know, you have to work to see behind the curtain, what is really going on. And that's free will. That's why we have choice. That's why we're not robots. We choose. We use our minds. We use our emotions in order to answer that question. What does God want? You know, is there a God? Where is God? What does He want? And then build a relationship. So that history is a means of seeing that as well. We are sort of at a period in history where we can look back and see, wow, that is quite amazing what we've been through. Since we were last in this place, you know, 2,000 years of history has transpired to bring us back to here. You know, we're moving. Life is becoming. We're going somewhere. So I think that now science is showing, the Torah tradition really is catching up. You know, cosmology, which is the study of how things began, the physical world. The Big Bang, we're talking the past 50, 70 years of amazing revelations in science, which not only do they not conflict with Torah, they confirm Torah. And that's powerful. But it takes a long time for, you know, humanity, for minds of men to change, to hear that. we're moving away from a secular definition, a man-made definition of the world. And it just doesn't work anymore, both morally and intellectually. To get back to a God-centered world, it's a process we're in. And it's a hard one. I mean, society is not there yet. A lot of reasons not to believe in God. Not all of them, most of them are not even intellectual. They're, I'll do my own thing. Leave me alone, I don't need to be told that there's a God. But it's good for you, It's the way to reality. And it's a hard one. But each person uses his free will and he comes to that, conclusion as well. And what we're seeing now is God's hidden face is opening up a little bit. That's the period that the prophets have told us we're going to come into. But the pre-messianic era, more light is going to come to the world, more wisdom, more reality. Those of us who are fortunate enough to have your antennas beamed in, you'll pick it up. And others who are more shut down will become a little slower. Next generation. But that's a process we're in.
I just wanted to mention something else, that it is possible to trace back the maternal part of your genes to the mitochondria.
That's right. It's a mother's line. That's right. That's right.
I don't know if that's how it is.
Well, they're studying that. When they're taking these samples, they look for the father's line through the Y chromosome, and the mother's line can be detected through this mitochondrial DNA. Most of the DNA is in the chromosomes, which are in the nucleus of the cell. However, also floating in the protoplasm of the cell is the mitochondria. They are what are called the energy of the cell. They're powerhouse of the cell. So but they carry also some DNA, so they replicate. But their DNA is only from the mother. It seems that what the father puts in is lost in the transmission. This is the egg cells we're talking about very early on in the process, so that there is actually a way to trace a common line from the mothers. In fact, they came out with about 10, maybe 15 years ago, what's called the mitochondrial Eve, the mother of us all. It also is a very powerful finding that they don't say one woman, but they say that they're so common, the DNA is so common among all of mankind that it indicates we had a common ancestor, because this was mDNA, a common female ancestor, a common mother. So they call her Eve. So again, all humanity with a common source, a common base, not, these developed here, these developed here, these. No, just as the Torah generally is. Now, the Torah is not a science book. Don't look for the Torah to tell you, the age of the earth and what came when. This has to be understood. Also, it's a very deep thing. We talk about 6 days of creation and the seventh day of Shabbat. So, on one level, it's literally true. But on the level that we really have to understand, it's a metaphor for a process of creation. Now, if somebody wants to understand that well and how it works with the DNA, if you're here for another week or two, I think Gerald Schroeder will return. He wrote this book, The Science of God, which puts together the age of the earth when humans developed. We're post-humans. All this DNA goes back a lot older than 7,000 years or 6,000 years. When we're talking about humanity, mankind, Adam Rishon, we're talking about civilization, we're talking about the addition of a soul to the physical form. But that's a whole another discussion. So thank you for your attention.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.